Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Whether it's her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct has everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Tech Stuff, a production from iHeartRadio. Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm your host, Jonathan Strickland. I'm an executive producer with iHeartRadio, and I love all things tech in general. So today, we're actually going to listen to a classic episode. I know it's not Friday and when we typically listen to classic episodes, but I feel like this one's getting super topical again, which is about electronic voting machines, or EVMs. I voted this morning in Georgia and had to go through and use an EVM. Now, unlike what the situation was back in 2016, when this episode you're about to hear originally published, Georgia has changed slightly. Back in 2016, the voting machines did not produce any sort of paper record. So there was no sort of receipt to show that the vote you were casting on the electronic machine was being reflected as the vote that was actually being recorded. Georgia has since changed that. Now, when you go through and you make your selections, it sends a paper ballot to be printed on a machine, which you then can look at, verify that, in fact, the information that you put on the electronic display is reflected on that paper ballot. But then you'd bring that paper ballot over to another machine and you scan the paper ballot in. So now you have a scanning machine that takes the paper from the electronic machine and scans that, which arguably just creates a different point of failure. But no system is perfect. The question we have to ask ourselves is, does this system provide more confidence in the overall process of voting than the previous system? I would say yes, because at least there was that physical copy. Not that you got to keep it. You actually could not leave with your paper ballot. So that's something. You didn't get a copy of it or anything like that. But I think it is a step in the right direction. However, I have a much deeper conversation with Mr. Ben Bolin of Stuff They Don't Want You to Know and Ridiculous History and many other things. And so we sat down to talk about the scary world of EVMs. This one is part one, and in our next episode on Monday, we will listen to part two. And I hope all of you are well. I hope you're all doing what you can to make the world a better place. And I'll see you on the other side.
Hey, Jonathan, thanks for having me on the show, and hello, Tech Stuff audience. I was really excited when you brought up this topic and asked if I wanted to hang out with you on it. However, before we go any further, I've got to ask, are you okay, man?
It's been a long week, Ben. It's been a long week, and it's been a weird day. This day did not unfold the way we first imagined it would, or at least not for me.
Too true.
And also, I figured that I needed to be really like up and upbeat and excited and happy before we go into this topic, because I guarantee you it cannot sustain itself as we talk about this. Also, you're going to hear some papers being shuffled around, folks, and that's because my computer decided that it was no longer going to connect to the wireless network once I took it away from my docking station. I think I figured out what the sequence of events was that caused it to do that.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, which largely involves being docked, removing the Wi-Fi, turning the Wi-Fi adapter off because I was getting blips, and then removing it from the docking station without enacting, you know, without enabling the Wi-Fi again, and now it won't do anything. So I just turned the computer off, and I'm using paper notes, which I understand are a thing.
And sometimes, how apropos, my friend, because sometimes people will argue that using paper-based documentation is more efficient, or at least less prone to error, than electronic documentation, such as, you know, notes we might share on a laptop.
Well, it certainly fixes things in a more permanent form, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because with electronic files, I don't know if you know this, Ben, but you can sometimes go in and change stuff.
What?
But if you printed something on a piece of paper, it's a lot harder to change the thing you printed on the piece of paper without it being noticeable. Now, you can change it in electronic format and print a new thing.
Malarkey. Poppycock.
Yeah. I don't wish to bamboozle you. I am no flim-flam man. So, today we're specifically talking, and you know from the title of the podcast, we're talking about voting machines today, electronic voting machines specifically, and what it is about electronic voting machines that have certain people kind of talking about security, transparency, that kind of stuff. And here in the U.S., we are hurtling toward an election, kicking and screaming all the way, as is typical every few years in the U.S. I mean, especially when it's a presidential election, which we have every 4 years. And so I thought it was really important for us to kind of talk about this. And of course, Ben, as a host of Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, there are a lot of conspiracy theories that surround voting in general, not just electronic voting machines, but the whole process.
Yeah, right? It's true. There are quite a few things that would be called conspiracy theories. There are also quite a few very valid criticisms or observations.
Absolutely.
About the nature of the voting system, everything from the nuts and bolts of the technology to the way technology disrupts existing legislative systems to just the organizational stuff. You know, the question that a lot of you guys probably have out there, ladies and gentlemen, is stuff like, why was Ross Perot the last third party candidate to make it to the, you know, the big kids table of debates?
Right. Actually getting put onto ballots.
Right.
On most states.
Right.
Or another great question that I hear all the time is, why the heck do we still have an electoral college?
Mm-hmm.
If we've evolved beyond the point where a bunch of very wealthy white landowners have decided that really we shouldn't give complete control to the hoi polloi when it comes to picking our leaders. We should have a protective layer in between the dirty masses and the enlightened leaders.
While the quotidian can't even appreciate a cool mint julep.
That's true. Yes. I hereby recognize the esteemed representative from the state of Virginia.
That's a great point. And before we get too far into it, one of the most salient or applicable quote unquote conspiracy theories about elections revolves around the idea that elections have been fixed retroactively or miscounted, whether intentionally or accidentally,
sure,
by a machine or the people in charge of the software running the machine.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, these are big questions, and we're going to talk about all of those. And in order to really get a full understanding of where we are today, I think it always helps to have a quick rundown of how we got to where we are, right? Mm-hmm. I love to do this on Tech Stuff where even if I'm going to talk about a specific technology, I tend to go back and say, well, here's how we got there historically. So voting's been around for a really long time, whether you're talking about like from an official capacity, like you go back to like the Greeks and mm-hmm. their voting, or you just talk about, you know, small groups deciding where they're going to, you know, what animal are we going to kill for tonight's meal? Mm-hmm. We had Mastodon last night. Come on.
Yeah.
Let's branch out. Well before Survivor ever took to the airwaves, we've had voting. And for a long time, we would tabulate these votes manually. You just have someone who would either just count up all the votes if you did some sort of voting, like through stones, like the white stone or the black stone to mm-hmm. vote on something.
Yeah.
Or very often, voting was done in public, where you didn't, you know, it was no secret ballot. You declared your vote in front of people.
Which, yay or nay.
Yeah. And that, I mean, it clearly has some advantages in the sense that you have verifiable votes, right?
Sure.
It has some disadvantages in that if you hold an unpopular opinion in your particular region, mm-hmm. you might find yourself ostracized from the larger community because you voiced that.
You may become a target, in
yes,
fact.
Yes, yes. I actually had a conversation with someone this morning about how they had suggested we move to a time where we would be able to assign votes to specific people so that for verification purposes. And I said, that's a terrible idea. And the reason it's terrible is because it favors the majority and it punishes the minority, right? Mm-hmm. If you are in the minority opinion and you vote your conscience, like you are not going to be cowed into voting the majority just because all these other people want you to. Then you stand, you know, victim, you're vulnerable to the majority who may punish you for your choice to vote your conscience.
Mm-hmm.
And, or you might just feel pressured to change your vote so that you keep yourself and your family safe. So secret ballots, I think, are really important. They actually came officially to the scene pretty late, especially when you're talking about standardized ballots. Those didn't become a thing until the mid-19th century. So 1856 was when we saw the first standardized ballots, meaning ballots issued by the government
mm-hmm.
with the candidates arranged in whatever order they had deemed was appropriate. Like, I don't know if they went alphabetically or how they arranged it, but the government had come to a decision on here's how we're going to present the ballot. It's standard for everybody. And that government was Australia.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. So it wasn't the UK, of course. It wasn't the US, which nope. a lot of people would assume.
Yeah. Now, there had been secret ballots in both the UK and the US, mm-hmm. but this was a standardized approach.
This was the new normal.
Yeah. This is where you're saying everyone's getting the same sheet of paper to mm-hmm. vote on, as opposed to if you went into a voting precinct in one part of the United States for, let's say, the presidential election, and then went to a voting precinct in a totally different state, the ballots could look dramatically different
right.
from one another and have have completely different presentation. Like, you could just imagine, let's say that you're going through a corrupt precinct.
Uh-huh.
And the candidate that they all want to win is in nice, big, bold print. And then the other candidates are in teeny tiny print
mm-hmm.
and you can barely see them. Like, that would be unfair, obviously. You would
sure.
you would say, like, I detect a sense of bias.
So this was Australia in the mid 19th century.
Yep.
I guess then the best way to organize the candidates would be by their crime in alphabetical order.
Right.
I'm so sorry, Australia.
As always, we love to poke fun at Australia for getting its start as a penal colony. Well, I mean, clearly the Aborigines have been there forever, but you know, from
the
European standpoint, hey, but before we get too cocky, Ben, we live in Georgia, a state that was a penal colony.
That's true.
For debtors.
Do we get a pass for that?
Yeah, because Georgia was a debtor's prison, essentially. Mm-hmm. If you've ever been in Georgia, you can understand how when Europeans got here, they first thought, yeah, this is where we want to put bad people.
So the Australian state would create these out of, I guess, taxpayer money.
Yep. Yeah. It was, and that was a big deal, right? Like the decision that, because anything the government does, you know, any product that they're going to make, anything they produce, the money for that comes from taxes. I mean, that's where governments get their money. So, you know, you're not going to the Australian government gift shop and buying a whole bunch of t-shirts and that money goes to making ballots. But once this was established, then it quickly caught, I was going to say caught fire, but that's hard to talk about when you're talking about paper ballots.
Yeah.
It got popular. It was adopted throughout the world. And so by the late 19th century, so the late 1800s,
just
inventors,
a few decades later.
Yeah, just a couple of decades later, inventors were already beginning to experiment with ways to create machines for voting. Things like using punch cards so that you could tabulate the data really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because especially as populations grow, and as you open up the vote to more eligible voters, as you make more people eligible.
True, yeah.
You know, keep in mind, this is the same period where we start to see various minority populations end up getting the right to vote. That increases your voting population. We see women get the right to vote. That increases your voting population. Being able to count those votes quickly becomes really important because you don't want to hold up, like, you don't want everyone waiting, like, we voted 3 weeks ago. When are we going to find out who won? You don't want that to happen.
Right.
So there were a lot of experiments in ways to tabulate votes more quickly. And also the idea was that this would be more reliable than a human, like less likely to make an error.
Less prone to user error.
Yeah. Or fraud. You know, you can't bribe a tabulation machine to give you incorrect results. You could program it to do that, but,
right.
But we'll get into that a little bit later. Now, even though people were working on it in the late 1800s, it would be another half century before you actually started to see some of these punch card systems make their way into voting booths. It just wasn't ready yet. And then we get into the first actual voting machines, and we get to a man by the name of Henry W. Spratt.
He sounds like a limey.
He is, or he was.
Can I say limey on the air? Is that okay?
Yeah, I mean, we can beep it out.
It's just going to sound like I said something worse.
The English blackguard. He was an Englishman, and he received a U.S. patent for a push-button voting machine back in 1875. And so imagine that you have a column of buttons, okay? And each button corresponds to a choice for a vote, for a single vote. Now, it's just a column. Or it could be arranged as a row. It depends on how you build it. But it's a single row or a single column. And you might have three buttons that are activated because you have three choices that you could choose from. You would choose, and then that's it. You only had that one option because it only had the one row or the one column.
But, oh, okay, I see.
So you like, in other words, like when we go in for an election, frequently we have multiple positions or issues that we're voting on.
Right. Not just the president or maybe a state rep or a state senator, but also comptroller,
council
person.
And people in the actual House of Representatives and the U.S.
Right.
Senate.
Right.
So you've got multiple positions that could be open. Well, you would need to have multiple rows or multiple columns so that you could make that kind of vote. And in fact, we did see those follow. But in 1875, we saw that first push button patent. That and several variations that follow were all purely mechanical devices. So no electricity here. These are all working from like levers and joints and hinges. And so it's actual just pure mechanical action, which is great. But also problematic because things can break down, things can jam. Like if you've ever used an old typewriter, sometimes, you know, the keys can jam. Same sort of thing could happen. I mean, especially with the more complex voting machines.
More moving parts creates just simply more opportunities for something to go wrong.
Exactly. More points of failure. Yeah. And so, one of my favorite inventions that came out fairly early was a lever that you would pull in order to close the curtain behind you. Now, Ben, I didn't even ask you this, but, have you, for all of your voting experiences, have you only used the direct recording type, the computer monitor types, or have you ever used a voting booth like with
I have
and stuff?
Used a booth very, very early in my political career.
Yeah.
which I think voting will count as my political career.
I was going to say, before you burnt all the bridges. And,
before I burnt the bridges and became an inspiration for several characters on House of Cards.
Yeah.
I was, in the very early days before this was instituted, I did get to experience, like, the older paper-based voting.
I did the old lever voting machines.
Yeah, yeah.
That used to be in Georgia before 2002. I'll talk about that more in a second. Mm-hmm. But the way that they typically would work, because once this innovation was introduced, it was adopted pretty much universally. You would have a lever that you would use to close the curtain behind you, and only then would the other levers become active, where you would be able to cast your vote.
Yeah.
So it was great because it meant that you were pretty confident that your vote would be done secretly. No one's going to look in on you, because before you could even get started, you had to close the curtain. Mm-hmm. You didn't have an option to vote with the curtain open. And typically the way it would work is that there'd be a mechanism that would just lock all the other levers in place until that curtain lever was activated.
And then that's cool.
Unlock. Yeah. It was really ingenious. It was, again, pretty simple. Even when you get to electromechanical voting booths later on, it still followed the same principle. And I thought that was really neat. Now, those voting booths were incredibly heavy and complex. And like I said, they would break down occasionally, which obviously that's a big problem.
They sound positively steampunk, if we're being honest.
If you were to ever like look in the back of one, you'd be pretty impressed. It would look kind of like a piano got in the fight with a copper store or something. It was pretty cool.
That is such a beautiful description. That might be your best writing this week. Like a piano got in a fight with a copper store.
Yeah. And then you got a lever action voting machine. In 1881, Anthony C. Baranek received a U.S. patent for a push-button voting machine that was more suited for American elections. This one had the multiple rows and columns, so it was more advanced than Spratt's. And then in 1889, Jacob H. Myers patented the first lever voting machine, also known as a direct recording vote machine, which used mechanical levers to indicate votes, and results were counted by the machine itself. And then what would happen is he would record the results. A human being would record the results from each machine for it to be tabulated in the grand totals. And Myers had said that the approach had major advantages over older methods in that it could prevent ballot stuffing, because each person could only use the machine once before it had to be reset. So you couldn't vote and then just go ahead and vote again and vote again and then just keep on creating, false votes for whatever candidate you chose. You could only do it the one time. Mm-hmm. And then it would have to be reset for the next voter, which meant that, it was a little labor intensive because you had to have someone there to reset the machine. But at the same time, it kept the voting process honest. And then the first time Myers' machine was actually used, I remember it was made in 1889, was 1892. So it didn't take long.
Wow.
And again, there still was a weak point here. If you had someone whose job it was to write down the results, they could fudge the results from the machine.
And let's also point out that here in the late 19th century, post-Civil War, at least in the U.S.
Yes, late 19th century is post-Civil War, even today.
I'm just saying with that having occurred so recently, corruption was rife and rampant.
Oh, yeah. Especially in – like there's certain areas of the United States that have almost a comical association with election fraud.
Chicago being the big one. Huh?
Like you'll hear stories about Chicago elections that are – amazing, like how many people turn out to vote in an election, including ones who haven't been alive for like 10 years.
Right. Boss Tweed kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, at any rate, this didn't erase the ability for, some tampering to happen, right? But again, it would be the humans. Ideally, the machines count all the votes as they were cast, but the humans whose job it was to transcribe that could fudge if they wanted, if they were so inclined. Not that they were allowed to, but they could have.
Right. Because there's a hierarchy of reporting here.
Yes.
Right? One person tabulates each machine after each vote, goes to a precinct tabulates it, goes to a higher authority of a regional sort, and then on and on and on.
Up to the national level, yeah.
And just like you said earlier, the more moving parts we have in a mechanism, whether an organization or a machine, the more potential points of failure we have.
Right. And this, again, kind of leads into the thinking that would eventually develop into the electronic voting machine. The idea being that, hey, if we can remove some of these steps, then perhaps we can end up having a more accurate reflection of the public's intent, right? Which, that's a very honorable thing, but it gets a little muddy in practice.
We still have a ways to go before we get there.
Yeah, we do. So 1930, lever voting machines had become a common sight throughout elections in U.S. cities. Most major cities had these by 1930. In 1962, Kern City, California, would use optical scan ballots for the first time. So these are like the standardized tests, like the SAT. I assume they're still like that. I haven't been in high school in a really long time. But, you know, the kind of tests where you have to fill in the bubble all the way to indicate your choice. That's what we're talking about, optical scans. So you've got your ballot, and you fill in the ballot as directed in order to make your choices. And then those are later put through a scanning machine. It's essentially like a camera. It just detects where the dots are.
Right.
And then it can tell who you voted for based upon the position of the dots. And obviously this means that you have to have very standardized papers so that they can load in properly, be read by the machine correctly, so that you don't get misidentified votes, that sort of stuff.
And you have to also have the seemingly unnecessary, but in practice crucial, instructions for every voter on what we actually mean when we say filling in a bubble.
Yes.
You know, no check marks, no X. You have to fill it in completely.
Right.
All the stuff you may remember from your SATs, ACTs, or LSATs.
Right. Right. Yeah. Because if you don't fill it in correctly, if you don't fill in that bubble fully, then it may not be counted. Mm-hmm. And obviously, every person who goes to the trouble to vote wants his or her vote to matter, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we don't just stand there just for the fun of it, maybe the first time. But after that, you're like, well, I'm doing my civic duty. It's not my civic, oh boy, let's go and do this.
remind me at some point when we get to the contemporary area, I have a great voting story for you.
Okay.
But right now, we've got the scanners, and then we move into something that's a little bit of local history for you and I.
Yeah, 1964, Fulton and DeKalb counties in Georgia used punch cards and computer tally machines for the first time in an election. Fulton and DeKalb counties are really the two main counties of Atlanta. If you look at Atlanta on a map, especially if you look up the term Metro Atlanta, there are a whole bunch of counties that are in that.
Pantheon.
There's like 13 or something. Mm-hmm. It's crazy at this point. But the two big ones that make up what we who live in Atlanta think of as Atlanta are Fulton and DeKalb. In fact, I think, Ben, I think you might live in one and I live in the other.
That is true. I'm currently a resident of Fulton County, though for a long time I was over there with you in DeKalb.
Yeah. And to be fair, I think only a couple of miles separate Ben's house and my house. So we're right there on the border of the two counties. Anyway, those two counties became the first to use punch cards and computer tally machines for the first time, and that would quickly get adopted by a lot of other places. In 1965, Joseph P. Harris would patent the Votomatic punch card system, and that would require voters to use like a stylus-like pen to punch holes into a ballot. This became very common, too.
And it was on a sort of a template thing, right? Like it would slide into this thing with the choices.
Yes.
And it would pop one that you chose.
Almost like a frame that would hold the paper taut.
Yeah, I remember those. And also, I want to point out, this is one of my favorite eras of American history for gadgets. It's the time when everything was legitimized by adding O-matic at the end. It was their digital or their organic, their buzzword.
Yeah. So if you look at any of the cafeterias from back then, there were a lot of the serve O-matic or whatever. And they tend to be, a series of windows, and you would put coins into a slot and you would be able to open up one of the windows and get your, you know, the ham sandwich that was made 7 hours ago.
Mm-hmm.
If you really,
feast of my heart, or just a jar of eggs.
Yep. Man, those are the days, right?
Ben and I have more to say about electronic voting machines, but before we get to that, let's take a quick break. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do.
Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So this is something that has an important difference, though, right? Because while the act here was just relatively simple human technology, a person popping a stylus into a piece of paper. How did they count this?
Again, you would put it through a tabulation machine. Typically, you would do this, again, using light to detect where the punched hole was. This also leads us to another issue in American elections later on, the dreaded hanging chads. But we'll get there. We'll talk about that. But it does open up the opportunity for tabulation errors, only because if the piece of paper that you are punching out isn't completely free of the ballot, like if it doesn't break off from the ballot, then it can obscure that hole, and a tabulation device could think that you made no choice whatsoever for that particular vote, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
1974, that was the first patent for a direct recording electronic voting machine, or DRE. These are also known as electronic voting machines, EVMs. They're essentially computers. They're computer terminals. And it was first used in 1975, and the first one that was used was called the Video Voter.
Voter.
Yeah. Now, typically these days, you have an electronic display that shows you the ballot, an electronic version of the ballot. And then you use some form of interface to make your choice. It might be buttons. So it might be a physical button that you have to press that corresponds to a choice you see on the screen. Or it may be a touch screen in some cases where your choices pop up. You press the screen, it activates, and your vote is reflected on what you see on the screen. At that point, a couple different things could happen. The vote could just be recorded electronically in memory, and then at the end of the day, what the precinct folks will do is remove the memory from each device, and then send that over to a centralized tabulation area, mm-hmm. and then the results would be collected there. Or it may also print a paper record so that you have a hard copy to compare against the electronic ones. Not all EVMs have paper trails. In fact, a lot do not, which is problematic. We'll get more into that.
And that sort of varies location to location.
Yeah, not even state to state, but within a state. You could have one area, one precinct where there's a paper trail and one where there's not. This is largely because in the United States, the decision on what sort of machine you're using is made at the local level. It's not federally mandated, right? The federal mandate is that you must have a system in place for people to vote. You got to have that.
Somehow,
yeah. Right? But beyond that, it ends up being a decision made on the local level. And there's been a lot of arguments about who should foot the bill for these systems. Should it be a state-level thing? Should it be regional? Should it be federal? And this is why we get a lot of disparity across the United States when it comes to different ways to cast a vote on mm-hmm. an election year. In 2000, this was a big, big year. This was the year that really started to change things here in the U.S.
Here we go.
Yeah, this is the year when Al Gore was running against George W. Bush. And it was a very close race throughout the United States. But
very close.
Particularly in Florida, which was seen as a state that was going to decide everything, right?
And also, to add to the allegations and the controversy here, the vote in Florida at the time could be influenced by the governor.
Who was brother to W.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you had polls, like the actual surveys, indicating that Gore actually had a bit of a lead in a lot of areas.
Not a huge lead, but a lead.
Enough of a lead to bring into question the results that came in later.
Right.
But then you also had this issue of the hanging chads in Florida. Millions, according to some sources, millions of votes were tossed out.
Right.
Because you had these ballots that had chads hanging from them and they could not be tabulated by the machines. And so rather than tear off the piece of paper, which would almost be seen as like – you could argue is a way of tampering. Like how could
right.
you be sure? Like what if you looked at a ballot and legitimately they had not made a choice mm-hmm. for a specific issue or a specific position?
Or you weren't sure if it just got messed up.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You don't know if maybe they started to tear and then they changed their mind. Like how far does the chad have to hang before you can make the determination, oh, this is what they meant to do?
And of course, I wish I had jumped in with this earlier, but when you talked about these millions of hanging chads,
yeah.
Of course, we're saying that the chad is the leftover piece.
Yeah,
the
perforated piece of paper. Yeah.
It's not, you know, a bunch of guys in backwards hats and cargo shorts right. hanging out, although I wish it was.
Yeah.
I wish that the...
I mean, yeah, I would expect to see a bunch of chads hanging out in Florida, but only on spring break.
Right. Okay. And no offense to people named Chad.
No,
I don't believe in nominative determinism, which is the smart word for, or the smart phrase for that kind of belief.
Yeah. Yeah. We're very intelligent about our short-sighted,
about
ignorance.
Our bad jokes.
Yeah.
So yeah, this is a huge deal though, because, people who support, the Republican candidate at the time, George, who would later become president, George mm-hmm. Bush, they say, well, this is how democracy works, and we have to make sure it's a clean election. And then the Democrats who are supporting Al Gore say, this is not how democracy works, and yes, we need to make sure there's a clean election.
Right.
These
yeah.
votes should count.
You can't just throw people's votes out the door because you don't like what they say and use the excuse that they don't fit your
right.
standard. And so this was an ugly, ugly mess.
Very much so.
All the way to the Supreme Court. That's how far this ugly mess went.
And and they eventually made the decision going back to I love that you put this in earlier. Going back to your comment about tabulating things in a timely manner.
Yeah.
Ultimately, right, the people who, of course, the winning party is going to fight and say there shouldn't be a recount.
Yeah.
Because they got it done the once.
Yeah, you don't – when you think about it, a recount to the winner sounds like you're doing the election all over again.
It's like double jeopardy.
Yeah, you don't want to run the risk of losing – again. You won. You want to keep moving. And, you know, you can't really blame someone for wanting that.
Right. So ultimately, the Supreme Court said, okay, like, we can't hold up the American political process. And they and the Supreme Court ultimately decided the president in that election.
Yeah. This was a big point of contention for lots of people on both sides, really, because there were people who were very concerned about what this set meant for future elections. Mm-hmm. And so in 2002, the U.S. government actually passed the Help America Vote Act, or HAVA, H-A-V-A, in response to the 2000 Hanging Chad debacle. And their goal was to phase out punch card systems entirely and use other systems. It didn't they weren't specific in saying you have to move to electronic voting machines. But just let's not have this happen again, because that was not pleasant. And so a lot of regions did opt to go with electronic voting machines. And in 2002, the first state to use DRE machines statewide, it is mandated at a state level, is Georgia.
Yeah, look at us. Take that.
Yeah, we're first in something.
Oh, we're first in several things, but this is one of the good ones.
Arguably.
Yeah. Arguably.
So it was interesting to see that Georgia was taking a leadership position in innovation in this way. But we should point out that in most states, electronic voting machines are not the only way you vote. In fact, in most states, there's some sort of combination of different voting methodologies. Some states you are you still mail in your vote. You don't even go to a polling place, because those states are known for having low populations dispersed across a wide area, and it's hard to make a journey all the way to a place where you can go and cast a vote.
Especially depending on the season, if there's inclement weather in a place like Alaska.
Yep.
You know, how can you realistically expect someone to travel all the way in? And then, you know, also the reason we have to depend on some hybrid systems is because we may have veterans or state level officials, people working for the government that are stationed abroad. Mm-hmm. We might have people who are living abroad for some reason or another. But if it's a legitimate reason, I guarantee you they want to vote.
Sure.
Usually against having their foreign income taxed at U.S. rates.
Yeah.
But then there are, you know, there are multiple people who, for one extenuating circumstance or another, need to send a vote, can't be physically at the machine.
Right.
So overall, it's good for us to have this mix, right?
Right. And you know, again, for a lot of places, it's it was not so much that we have to move to electronic voting machines. We just had to move off of punch cards. So one of the other sad things about Georgia, though, is that in a lot of areas, the machines being used are essentially the same ones that were launched in 2002.
Which means we have early adopter syndrome.
Yeah. Well, we also have the problem that a lot of people have when they get into PCs for the first time, which is that they realize they have to upgrade every few years.
Yeah.
We have not done that in a lot of states, including Georgia. And this also comes into play with the idea of the expense, right? You have to pay to get those new systems in, and that means you have to allocate taxpayer money to do that. And I don't know if you've noticed this, Ben, but a lot of taxpayers aren't keen on the whole idea of paying more tax.
Right.
Which means that if you aren't paying more tax, then you have to take money away from something else in order to pay for the electronic voting machines. And it's hard to make that a politically positive move. It is difficult to justify that, because there's so many different interested parties. And if you were to say, hey, this group over here, I know that we typically budget a certain amount every year for you guys, but we're going to decrease that budget a little bit this next year so that we can put that toward electronic voting machines.
Uh-huh.
And then that group says, why are you punishing us? And I'm not trying to pass judgment here. I understand, like, it's a difficult political game to play.
And then we have to also ask, you know, what private industry is involved with this?
Yeah.
So I'm just gonna, I don't want to go, I know we'll get into it later, but I do want to point out, you know, when we're asking that question, or when we're bringing up the point of how difficult it is to ask taxpayers to pay more in tax so that these machines can be serviced.
Yeah.
The government's not paying itself to do it. In the case of Georgia, they're paying someone called Premier Election Solutions.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just good.
Pretty
just
sure Premier Electric Solutions used to be Diebold Election Solutions. and we'll get into Diebold in a minute.
Yeah.
So over the next several years from 2002 on to today, various security experts and civil rights groups have been challenging the use of DRE systems in elections for various reasons.
Yeah.
In 2012, issues with the election in New York City were so bad that in 2013, the city would actually pull 5,100 lever voting machines out of storage to use instead of electronic voting machines.
Sheesh.
Yeah.
Well, it's a good thing they kept them, huh?
Yeah.
So whoever was in charge of keeping all that old stuff, I'm sure you listened to Tech Stuff and, hey, you're no longer a hoarder.
Yeah. Now you're a patriot.
Yeah.
So what are some of the advantages? Okay, before we get into all the criticisms, and then we're going to also address the fear of the 2016 election being hacked, because that has been in the news for a while.
Yeah.
Let's talk about what are some of the good things about electronic voting. Well, first off, speed is huge, right? Like you can collect and tabulate votes faster through this method than through any other method. And assuming that everything is working the way it's supposed to, then you know you've got a really accurate result, and you can very quickly proclaim a winner in whatever district you're talking about. So there's very little delay between the end of voting and declaring who the winner is using those methodologies, because you don't have to go through any laborious process to tabulate the votes.
And that's inarguable.
Yeah. I mean, that's it's like any other computer program. You know, you typically, unless you're talking about a computer whose processor is just laboring under way too much work, you get results very quickly. Another is that there are no moving parts in the actual voting mechanism. An electronic voting mechanism, purely electronic, we're not talking about electromechanical. You don't have moving parts, so that means they don't wear down over time physically. That being said, you could still have errors pop up in electronic voting machines. You could have operational errors. Things can crash. It's a computer program. And I'm sure all of us out there have had experiences where inexplicably a computer has crashed, or in my case, failed to connect to the Wi-Fi. And so that is still an issue, but because there are no moving parts, you don't have to worry about the physical wear and tear the way you would with those mechanical devices.
But wait, as Billy Mays was wont to say, there's more.
Yeah, so one of the big advantages of electronic voting machines, and I think this is a really important one, is they are customizable so that citizens are able to – more citizens can participate in the voting process. For example, if you have people who have visual impairments, like they can see but they might have trouble reading something that's in small print – because it's on an electronic screen, most of the time you have an option for a large print version. But beyond that, if you have someone who has a complete visual impairment, perhaps they're blind or they're effectively blind, then you can have audio versions as well. So it's an you can't really do that with mechanical ones, right? Like you can't magically make the print on a series of levers larger.
Right.
But with a screen, you can do that. So it creates more accessibility for a larger number of people who want to participate in the system.
However, not all electronic voting machines are created equally.
No. Okay. Yeah,
I wish you guys could see this in the studio. I just did president hand really well.
With the thumb slightly extended and the fist clenched, and then you do all your gestures. You know why you do it that way, right?
So because you're not pointing at
exactly
people.
Because if you point, then it almost feels like an accusation.
Right.
They train you. President 101, you get trained. Don't point. So your basic DRE is just a computer, right? So it records votes cast on the device. Typically, you would use – here in Georgia, you tend to get like a card, an activation card that you plug into almost like a little disk drive.
Yeah.
And then you can make your votes, and then you are told to remove the card at the end of it, and then you turn it back into somebody – and a volunteer at your little polling place.
Like Dirty Jimmy.
Yeah.
I'm kidding.
Dirty Jimmy, the volunteer at Ben's polling place. I'd like to point out that DeKalb County has much more respectable volunteers at their polling centers.
Along with free sassafras.
Yeah, you get a little bit of that, some sarsaparilla.
Sarsaparilla is actually what I was thinking of. I'm just not fit for Fulton County.
It's fair. I mean,
there are differences.
Ben and I will conclude part one of the scary world of EVMs in just a moment, but first, another quick break.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of 7 questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go, right? There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. On NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's part existential deep dive and part game show. I ask actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to ask some of life's biggest questions. Listen to NPR's Wildcard on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
So you got lots of different companies that make these, right?
Sure.
There's no standard across them. And in fact, that ends up causing an issue. But once you make those selections on your computer screen, you get kind of two broad types of DREs. In one type, it's all recorded just electronically. So all you have is the electronic record of the votes. In the other one, you have some sort of paper trail. Now, the paper trail ones, you can even divide again, because there's some where you have a paper trail, but there's no way for the voter to verify that the vote recorded on paper reflects their specific choices.
Mm-hmm.
So, Ben, I'm going to give you an example. All right. Let's go back in time, and you are picking between, Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan.
All right.
You got your choices of Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan, but back in this time period, this alternate history, they do have electronic voting machines.
Oh, okay.
Wrap your mind around that.
I'm wrapped.
So there you are. You're looking at Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan, and you being a huge fan of Reagan's Hollywood career.
Uh-huh.
You've decided you're going to support Mr. Reagan and not Mr. Carter, the Georgian native.
Right, so I'm going against the home team.
Yeah, you're going against the home team. And this is one of those cases where you are very pleased that your vote is secret.
Yeah, because my love of Westerns compels me yes. to vote my cinematic
and chimpanzees.
Conscience.
And chimpanzees.
So, okay, yeah.
So, bedtime for Bonzo or whatever it was.
So secret vote. And yeah, secret I'm vote. Like and
you,
for the Gipper.
You choose the Gipper. You choose Ronald Reagan. And in the distance, you hear, which indicates that indeed the printer has printed out the lines that are supposed to reflect your vote, but you are not able to see the piece of paper. So for all you know, the mm-hmm. piece of paper actually says Jimmy Carter was the one you voted on. And so while the review screen that mm-hmm. you get says you picked Ronald Reagan, electronically it records that vote as a vote for Jimmy Carter, and on the paper it says it's a vote for Jimmy Carter. And since you can't see the paper, you can't say, hey, wait a minute. That's not who I voted for.
I let down the Gipper.
You didn't, because you voted. You did everything you could. Now, there's also the voter verifiable paper trail. And the voter verifiable paper trail means that you would be able to see the paper representation of your vote before you leave the precinct.
Yeah.
So in that case, you vote for Ronald Reagan. Piece of paper prints out. It says you voted for Ronald Reagan. Now, I should add, there's still the possibility that electronically it right. flips your vote.
But for that to happen and for it to essentially flip back at some point, for it to purport
yeah.
that you have voted what you thought you were voting for, that makes – let me put it this way, Jonathan.
Yeah.
And I know that we are going to go back and forth on some of this, and that's fine. But
yeah.
that's a very – that's a difficult mistake to make.
In other words, that's not a mistake. That's something someone did on purpose.
It seems more plausible that it would be like something that involves those points mm-hmm. occurring. Register electronically. Let's say I do vote for Big Gip and then have the verifiable paper trail come out, says, hey, congratulations, you voted Ronnie. But then have the machine somehow register that as a vote for an opposing candidate.
No, I would argue that I can't think of a scenario where you could innocently do that. Right. Because you have to remember that the way these systems tend to work is that you get a verification screen at the end that says, hey, is this what you wanted before you actually cast your vote? Right.
Right.
So that electronic screen is going to, in theory, reflect what you actually chose. And if you look down, you're like, yep, there's Ronald Reagan. That's who I picked.
Mm-hmm.
And then the piece of paper says, after you cast your vote, the piece of paper prints out and it says Ronald Reagan. Like, yep, that's who I picked. But electronically, it says Jimmy Carter. I say something hinky has gone on and it 99.99999% sure that it was somebody doing that on purpose.
I've got to confess, I'm surprised that I'm surprised that you're drawing the same conclusion so quickly, because you're very the way that you evaluate situations, and you guys know, Jonathan, you listen to this show, is to go through all of these facts. So to hear you say something with this certitude,
yeah,
is pretty significant.
Well, and it's because I understand the technology, right? Like if you've designed a system, first of all, in order to get any electronic voting system in place, it has to go through lots of different third party testing to make sure that it actually works, right? So for it to pass all those tests and then magically not work properly on election day tells me someone has interfered, whether it was someone on the actual manufacturing side, like someone on the software side for the company that made the voting machine, or some other third party actor who has infected a machine with malicious code to change votes on the electronic level. The whole point of this, though, is that if you have a paper trail,
mm-hmm.
especially a voter verifiable paper trail, that's the most important kind.
Yeah.
Then you have something against which you can perform an audit after an election. So the election's over. The mm-hmm. results are in. And then a lot of states, not all, but a lot of states require a post-election audit where they will compare the electronic results against a hard copy of the results. If it's a voter verifiable hard copy, then theoretically, every single voter had the opportunity to see that his or her vote was actually recorded as intended. And that means that if there is a disparity, then you could bring that up and say, hey, we're going through this and there seems to be some significant differences between the electronic copy and what's on the hard copy.
Right. Like, hey, some of us voted for Hillary Clinton, some voted for Donald Trump, and a couple for some third party candidates, but every vote here is for Gary Busey.
Yeah.
What gives?
Yeah. That's a terrifying future that I had never, ever considered.
Oh, man.
But in the Reagan-Jimmy Carter example we gave before, you could say, well, according to this paper copy, this one person who happens to be Ben, but they don't know that because voter identity is very important. We want to keep that anonymous.
And I go in disguise based on our earlier series about how to use the internet and without being caught.
Right. So Ben, they don't know it's Ben, but they look and they see this voter record that says – this person voted for Ronald Reagan, but electronically it says Jimmy Carter. Something is wrong.
And then
could be a better investigation.
Yeah, it's great to have that.
But we'll go more into why that's not working everywhere in just a second. So this kind of brings us into those concerns more formally. We've already kind of addressed a big one. Mm-hmm. But if your goal is to make voting and tabulation easy and efficient, then if everything's working properly, there's no tampering involved, there's no bias that's been introduced either unconsciously or purposefully, mm-hmm. then it's a beautiful world.
And beautiful. Bellissima.
You get those votes in, you're done with it, and you get the winner and the loser can be gracious and defeat and all that wonderful stuff. But it's really hard to make sure that your vote is being counted the way you want it. So first of all, there are a lot of electronic voting machines that have no corresponding paper trail at all.
Right.
So
quite a few.
Let's say that again, Ben, you voted for Reagan and the votes come in and they announce the results for Georgia. And it's like 97.3% of voters voted for Jimmy Carter. Well, you don't know if you were in that small percentage that didn't vote for Carter. You would have no way of knowing. You're one person.
I would have nothing to refer to except perhaps circumstantial evidence based on exit polls or pre-voting polls.
Right.
So I could say, what the heck happened? There were, 55% of us last week.
Did we all just not go?
Forget about King's Row, Bedtime for Bonzo?
I told you Bedtime for Bonzo. I knew that was the chimp one. I don't have a computer in front of me. That was purely from memory.
That's just because you care.
Yeah, it's because I care.
That's a great point. So aside from that, there would be no, certainly nothing with a legal basis.
Right.
No legal leg to stand on.
Yeah. So, that would be problematic. The only thing that would make you really suspicious if they said 100% of all Georgia voters supported Jimmy Carter, and you'd think, I'm pretty sure I didn't. But, any system where someone's going to do tampering, you would figure they'd be smart enough not to make it so noticeable that there would be an investigation to follow, right? Like, your whole goal is to do this clandestinely and not get caught. So if you're doing that and you're being careful, you would want to design a system where it's not a blowout for a state where it might have been close leading up to the election. So if there is no corresponding paper trail, then you have nothing to audit against. All you have is the electronic copies. And as we know, you can alter electronic copies. Now, it's in the best interest of all the companies that create these electronic voting machines to be as secure as possible. Unfortunately, that never happens.
Right.
Security on electronic voting machines is a joke.
It's terrible. As a matter of fact, Wired released a pretty scary article.
Yeah.
Which you're already aware of it, back in August of 2016.
Yes.
Title being America's Electronic Voting Machines Are Scarily Easy Targets.
Yeah. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Jonathan.
So you and I kept talking after this bit that we just stopped just now.
Yeah, yeah.
For a while.
It's true.
So what happened, ladies and gentlemen, is that when we finished talking, we stepped outside to look and see how long we had been talking, because we don't currently have a producer sitting at our desk to maintain the recording, just because we got lots of stuff. We got lots of things going on.
The thoughts and jokes and facts. And
got a lot of ins, got a lot of outs.
Uh-huh.
You know, got a lot of Big Lebowski's happening.
Uh-huh.
And so it turned out we had been recording for almost 2 hours, and we realized that's probably too long for a single episode. So we're going to conclude part one here. But next week we're going to pick up with part two right where we left off. We got a lot more to say. So Ben will be back in part two because he never left. And
that wraps up this part one of the two-part series about electronic voting machines. On Monday, we will listen to part two, and we will get the conclusion where Ben and I are talking all about the issues around electronic voting and what we can do to make sure that the process remains intact, that we don't lose confidence in it. Because if we lose confidence in the process, then democracy itself sort of falls apart, right? If you don't trust that the votes you are casting are being counted, then you don't have any trust that the people who are representing you are actually representing you, that the game is fixed, and that is a problem. But we'll listen to that part two next week. I hope you guys are well, and I'll talk to you again really soon.
Tech Stuff is an iHeartRadio production. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Fedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. This week, I talked to Tiffany Haddish in a hilarious, deep, thoughtful interview where we dive into family trauma, grief, sobriety, love, and dating.
I got a big heart, and I'm very forgiving, but, like, don't abuse it. It's been abused enough.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss this one.